So, Ken, thanks for sitting down with us.
Thank you.
You and I come from the same space, if you will, and Tom as well, right? We came from the good old outsourcing days, and we've seen those contracts evolve over the years. And for the most part, you know, one can kind of, maybe we can agree that's a fairly mature space, although maybe you do a lot of outsourcing contracts. However, we can agree that in this new space, RPA, intelligent automation, AI, it's fairly new to the majority of the people, certainly the members within my network and likely the majority of your clients. Are you sensing that? And at the end of the day, what are the differences?
No, we're definitely sensing it. I think that the shift in the paradigm going from outsourcing through to RPA and down the paradigm through to AI is changing a lot of things. It's the existing contracts, the structure isn't really set up for these types of transactions. Particularly the deal cycles. I think that the deal cycles traditionally were looking at longer term transactions. Now for these deals, technology is changing so fast, we need to look at the ability to look at shorter deal cycles, shorter service cycles, and looking at the next technologies brought in sooner.
So before we even go there, so Tom, we're talking about people that are comfortable in the labor arbitrage zone, right?
Yeah.
Most of our members, your clients,
right,
they've been thinking people, things along those lines. And now we're talking about digital labor. Isn't this a big mind shift or no?
It is, you know, because the market's not linear anymore. So this rapid pace of change, you know, Ken was talking about a more frequent touch to the arrangement. I think, you know, I don't think we're going to deviate from, say, 5-year contracts plus or minus. But I think we have to go into a 5-year contract with the notion that we're probably going to mutually decide to touch it halfway through and tune it up. And the tune up can be minor or major, but, you know, we're in discussions with Ken and his partner around how we do that more collaboratively and with clients and go to them with a proactive story to say, how can we do this so that everybody wins in this? Because if we try to use the old playbook for the new model, I think we're going to get frustrated.
No, I agree. I agree because this traditional deals were structured in a way where you talked about things like the transition costs and bearing them in and looking at it over time. These shorter deal cycles aren't going to allow for that. The technology costs are different. The service costs are different. The ROI is different, and it comes at different times. So the touch point, you know, in a 5-year deal, I think is really critical to have that. Without having a touch point, I'd argue even for a shorter deal cycle, I think you're not going to get to a full 5-year deal.
So Tom, every time I see a deal that is a kind of a subscription-based deal, as a service-based deal, I think of what you kind of predicted maybe 5 or 6 years ago, that these would be easy in, easy out type agreements. And in many cases, some of them are.
Right.
Is that good or is that bad?
I think it's good. I mean, I advise clients that if the long-term 10-year contracts, and there are still some of those, a few of those left, if that's getting married, you're better off in this market dating. So someone was asking me before about which RPA platform to choose. There's many to choose from, UiPath, AA, Blue Prism, there's a bunch of them. But I wouldn't get married to any one of them because the platforms are changing, the technology is changing too rapidly. So you have to be very adroit. And, you know, that's why we're looking to work collaboratively with firms like Loeb & Loeb to, before we get into a client situation that we work out as a consultant with the law firm, how we have a similar talking point to how we adapt to this change. I don't have all the answers. I don't think Ken has all the answers either. That's why we're having these conversations. So when we go to sit with clients, so we say, look, here's a better way to do it. Not the best way, but a better way to do it.
Fair enough. So, but here's what I see, Ken. I'm not a lawyer, clearly, but the biggest difference I see is around data. Meaning, who at the end of the day, who owns the data? Does the provider own the data because they're bringing in all the smarts and the tech? Does the buyer own the data because they're paying for it? This is where I see a lot of consternation. Are you seeing that as well?
Absolutely. I think part of it has to do with deal structure. I mean, it's one thing to talk about standalone RPA, standalone automation that's installed by the company itself. It's another to be part of a service offering. So when it's brought into an offering as part of an outsourcing transaction, I think that they're approached differently from the supply side as to what rights there are. From a customer perspective, it's several fold. One is, do I own the data? And what rights do I have to use it? So it's going forward, am I locked in, as you said earlier? This question about being locked into a particular solution. If it's your data and you're implementing these difficult processes and you're changing, how is it that you continue without getting locked into a particular solution on technology? Mm-hmm. The flip of it is you have to make sure you have the rights to use it. And it's very, very easy to implement all these, not so easy necessarily, but as you're implementing these new technologies, now the question is, do you have the right to do the expanded use you want to do with this data? So it's not just ownership, it's also rights to use. And you have to rethink, what am I using and where did I get it from?
In fact, the consulting tension on this is, I want to make sure we're working with the attorneys on these deals ahead of time to avoid an overly conservative approach to the data, because while I want to protect my downside risk, I don't want to do so in a way that eliminates my upside. And the upside comes in two dimensions. It comes from the ability of the service provider to underwrite the transition costs, because it still costs money to transition, but I don't want to pay for it because the deal's too short. So they'll pay for it. It's almost like the old cell phone market in the U.S. where they give you the phone if you buy the contract. The second upside is, well, there's this real upside. They start providing advantages to you in terms of monetizing that data. So I just think we want to be thoughtful about that, create some tension in the process so that our downside protections on data from a legal perspective do not eliminate or obfuscate the upside potential.
I agree, except I think there's a little bit of a tug going on. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that the enterprise on the buy side has definitive needs to use data for its business needs. On the flip side, you have the suppliers who are now aggregating data across their customers and creating larger databases and trying to use that and leverage that across their customer base and creating something new and unique. So there's a tug there about who's going to own that.
Oh, absolutely.
And how you
use it. Well, here's where it gets more interesting. I predict that the next 24 months or so, you'll begin to see buyers actually seeking to commercialize the data, not just the sell side. So I think there'll be a handful of kind of forward-thinking enterprises that realize that has value in the market. Maybe it's not of strategic competitive value to them. And they say, hey, we're a bank. Maybe the other banks could use this, or we're a hospital. Another hospitals can use this. And suddenly it goes from a cost or just some asset, right, to could be millions of dollars. I'm thinking those become interesting conversations, right? And that tug of war becomes a little bit more intense.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to start it. As we start thinking about the shift in the paradigm, that's where the contracts need to catch up, because the current contracts aren't dealing with those issues properly.
No, I agree.
So Tom, I'm curious what you think, buddy. I'm sorry. When you think about ways to consume this tech now, if you will, you could go to a software player,
right?
Or you can just go to a service provider. Do you have a preference? And then based on your answer, I'm curious. What Ken thinks, just from more of a risk mitigation standpoint, are you advising your clients just to go to the software players and just buy the tech and bolt it all on and make it work? Or do you like this concept of kind of one-stop shopping and buy the results?
I would be self-aware about myself as a firm. So if you buy the tech, it's equivalent to buying a car in the form of the spare parts. You don't have transportation if you do that. You have to put it together. So firms like in the financial services industry that has top talent and the biggest budgets for tech implementations, they can afford to go do that. Firms in, say, healthcare or retail manufacturing probably don't have the same kind of budgets and typically don't attract the same kind of talent pools to go do that. I would be looking to buy outcomes. Mm-hmm. But... you know, in a fast-changing market, time is your enemy. And the pursuit of perfection, or the perfect being the enemy of the good, people would do very well for themselves to act quickly on good and not seek out perfection.
I agree. Ken, how do you weigh in on this?
No, I do agree. But I do think still there's a tug. And that's not going to resolve itself without a lot of discussion. It also goes to the financials of the transaction, right?
Yeah.
I think that where those issues wind up are going to change the financials, and sometimes the financials are going to be the deciding factor of doing this or not doing this. It has to be funded somehow.
One interesting aspect, Frank, of this as a service trend is the shift of capital risk moves from the buyer to the seller. So if I start selling things as a service, I am responsible for the capital involved in that service. In an old typical arrangement, the clients would own the assets and the services would be performed on top of those assets. Now, as we move to as a service, and I shifted on the, if I'm a, let's say a financial services and I shift my IT operations and I move my assets over there, I better start thinking about that because my clients are starting to move their capital to my balance sheet because they want to buy my services as a service. So this, we're having this, what I'll call left shift of capital risk, which is another change that we have to think through in this next wave of outsourcing agreements is how are we going to manage that capital risk in the form of termination agreements and rights, who owns repo rights. There's a whole bunch of issues around demonetization of your balance sheet.
Great. And that leads to the what I'll call the freedom to operate. I'm doing air quotes around freedom to operate. So that allows the customer to be able to know if something goes awry, if the deal doesn't go as planned, if something happens to my supplier, I can still exit the transaction and continue taking the benefit of what I had.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these transactions currently aren't set up to address the financial aspects, what happens
the hostage crisis situation.
Correct.
Right. We want to avoid that.
Okay. Ken Adler, longtime friend, go-to guy in the industry. Thanks for taking time with us today, buddy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.